Hey there, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. It's News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, .com, PRN.FM. You can join us on the phone at 888-874-4888. That number again for the free call, 888-874-4888. We're going to be talking in this hour about the economy, and we're also going to be talking about post-May Day Occupy. We're going to introduce you again to David DeGraw, whose AmpStatus.com was the site that really defined the notion of the 99% versus the 1%. David will be on with us, we hope, on the phone. And joining us in the studio, believe it or not, the Occupy Guitar Army. Welcome. Hey guys, welcome. Welcome. We'll hear some more from the Guitar Army in a few minutes. Tell us just briefly a little bit about, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about the Guitar Army.
Sure. Thanks for having us on, Danny. In the studio, you have Steve, Alfonso, Bill, and Daniel from the Guitar Army, Guitar Me, as it's properly pronounced. And basically, we are also members of the Occupy Wall Street Music Working Group, who puts together music actions to support the various social justice initiatives that we're doing with Occupy. So we launched our first Guitar Me action on May Day. We did a musical march from Bryant Park to Union Square, led by Tom Morello. We're singing social justice songs all the way down, and it was absolutely magical. I think we're really excited for the future, for this exciting summer coming up and everything.
This is the week of Pete Seeger's 93rd birthday. It's also the 100th anniversary,
exactly,
centennial of Woody Guthrie's work. So having a Guitar Army is quite appropriate,
yeah.
And it's great to have you here. And I was at Union Square, heard Tom, heard you guys play. It was very inspiring. We're going to hear some more. We're waiting to know if DeGraw is on the line. When he does join us, please let us know. Goldie is apparently in the house as well. One of the people, we're in a shoebox size studio. We have no less than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people plus myself. So,
yes,
we're going to try to do the best we can. It's not really set up for perfect sound, but it is set up to amplify the passions and the concerns of the Occupy movement, which we've been doing on this program almost every single week. So here you are, and there they are, and we're going to hear some more. Matt, let me know when we reach DeGraw. In the meantime, guys, how about another tune from the Guitar Army, the Occupy Guitar Army? And by the way, if you're listening to this, sing along at home.
Yeah, so this is one we do, One Guitar by Willie Nile.
I'm a soldier marching in the army, got no gun to shoot, but what I got is one guitar. I got one guitar. I'm a soldier marching in the army, got no gun to shoot, but what I got is one guitar.
David DeGraw, welcome. I don't know if you've been listening to this, but we have the Guitar Army in this tiny little studio with us. The Guitar Me,
yeah,
as it's known. Goldie is in the house. Catherine Waters, Cat Waters, has been singing along with the Guitar Me. I've been not wanting to sing along because I might ruin the sound, but getting sound in this little studio is interesting in itself. David, how are you up today?
Good, Danny. What's up, Goldie, Catherine, Danny? How you all doing over there?
Everybody's good. Not everybody can hear you, but, you know, you and I spoke on May Day, which was very good. And, in fact, you'll be happy to know that the audio worked despite all the loudness, all the noise, all the speaker talk that was going on behind us. We did get something that's very usable from you, and I wanted to start off that way. You know, May Day was the coming out party, if you will, officially in the spring of Occupy. How, as one of the people who've been involved from the beginning, what was your sense of it? What was your experience, and what did you feel was accomplished?
Well, I thought it was a great way to kick off the summer. You know, it was a large turnout. I mean, the guitar-y that, you know, Goldie Wooten and the OWS Music Group worked on was really an awesome way to start off what was going to be a wild summer with the help of Tom Morello and the band there. You know, I was impressed. The turnout was solid, and you know, I hope this is the start of a long line of actions. I mean, I know it is the start of a long line of actions.
You know, the right-wing columnist was saying, well, it was a total failure because they didn't shut down the city. The city is still here. They didn't overthrow capitalism. They didn't go to the moon or whatever else he believed that was going to happen on that day. And as a consequence, he was basically saying, you know, it was no big deal. But it did seem to be a big deal for the people who took part in it.
Yeah, I mean, the march from Bryan to Union Square was large, and I was impressed by it. But the march that went from Union Square, you know, down to Battery Park, downtown, I mean, I thought it was phenomenal. I mean, that was a huge turnout. You know, I thought the numbers rivaled that Foley Square action we had early on. I mean, the crowd was massive. I mean, the energy and the vibe was electric. You know, I mean, Occupy is here to stay. There's no question about that. I mean, as you know, Danny, the organizing activity that was happening last summer compared to what's happening right now is just night and day. You know,
one of the things I was struck by was I was up at, you know, Bryant Park behind the public library. It was pouring, you know, 7:50 in the morning. I looked over at the park and here were all of these umbrellas, and under each umbrella was one cop taking refuge from the rain. I'm saying, where are the occupiers? I don't see anybody. And then I walked around the corner and, yep, there was a bunch of people straggling in. And then I heard about this whole idea of 99 pickets, you know, that they were coming to Bryant Park, but leaving Bryant Park and picketing the Bank of America, picketing Rockefeller Center. I ran into some pickets at the Standard & Poor's rating agency at McGraw Hill. Seemed like there was a lot of energy at Fox News. There was a whole group of people basically saying to Fox News, hey, guys, how about paying your taxes, which is not an issue that we really knew much about, that Fox News didn't pay any taxes. So, you know, that was quite significant. And one of the things I learned was that there had been one working group dealing with labor prior to all of this. And in the weeks running up to May Day, there were five working groups reaching out to labor. And it seemed like labor was responding. There was also a great response from immigrant rights groups, people who really were at risk being there, you know, because of their immigration status, where they could have been arrested, but they weren't. There were some arrests. I think the number of Occupy arrests is over 7,000 now, you know, since the beginning of Occupy, which is very significant. And it also shows the militarization of the police and their hostility to freedom of expression. Seems like one of the things that Occupy is inadvertently fighting for, even if its economic objections are paramount, it's fighting for the, you know, the right to be heard, the right to assemble, the right to protest, the right to speak out, which is being snuffed out by, you know, our liberal mayor, Mayor Bloomberg here in New York, and the NYPD. Catherine was at a meeting last night where there was a gathering of people who were interested in reforming the NYPD. What was that about?
It was called Proc.
Hold on. Let's get a mic up here. There he's on. She's on the yellow mic. Go ahead.
Oh, PROP, Police Reform Organization Project. It was held at the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and its current and former captains and police officers coming out and admitting about the quotas and just looking at
when
the public.
When you say the quotas, let's not assume everyone listening knows what that means. The quotas means they have to arrest people, even if those people are not guilty of anything, right?
Right. Isn't that? Totally innocent. And they do target poor neighborhoods, young people that just haven't done anything wrong. And the guy who was on ABC, he actually came out about it on the mainstream media. He was there, with a panel of about six.
So this is sort of significant because, of course, at Occupy Enzucati Park, we had a captain from the Philadelphia Police Department in uniform who came almost every single day to support Occupy.
Ray,
and now he was on our program here as well. Now New York City police are beginning to speak out. You know, there's an environment of intimidation, of people feeling threatened. People,
Danny, as you know, the prison industry is just a booming industry. The per capita prison rate in the United States is just off the charts. No one's even close. The per capita rate in the U.S. now is equivalent to the darkest days of the Soviet gulag. I mean, as insane as that sounds. And, you know, you can look at the Rockefeller drug laws and basically cutting housing programs by billions and at the same time putting those billions into building prisons. And again, as I always harp on, as you know, it all comes down to this system of political bribery. You get people like the American Legislative Exchange Council who basically are writing these laws. They're writing drug laws. They're overwhelming the lobbying system. And, you know, the prison industry is just a booming industry.
Well, the prison is apparently the corporate-run prisons have now offered to take over by the state systems. If the states can guarantee, you know, that they will remain full so they can make money off the prisoners. So the states.
There are more African-Americans in jail now than there were slaves during the 1850s in the time of Abraham Lincoln. It's pure insanity.
So one of the things we were talking about, speaking of insanity, and I thought you really gave us a very good digest of all of this, is the extent of economic inequality in America. By the way, you should know, David, that Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, is in a speech last night said Occupy has some legitimate complaints. He didn't say what they were because a number of them are about him. But nevertheless, the fact is that he is now acknowledging, you know, hey, we got a problem here. But you've done this book, The People of the United States, I guess, versus the elite. What's it called exactly? And what's the core finding?
The economic elite versus the people of the United States. I mean, it's just an analysis of the inequality of wealth in the United States. You know, U.S. millionaire households have a total of $46 trillion in wealth. Over the past generation, there's been such a, as we all know, there's been such a consolidation of wealth. But I think one of the key findings for me is that an entire generation has no clue how much wealth has been consolidated within 0.01% of the U.S. population. There's no historical reference. You know, over the past generations, with technological advancement, production and profits has just exploded, and all that has gone to the top. You know, everyone knows the story by now. Wages have stagnated and declined. Meanwhile, you know, 0.1%, 0.01%, even further. 400 families have, 400 people have as much wealth as half the U.S. population. And, you know, I think it's just all a result of the rigged, corrupt political system where you buy politicians through campaign finance, you buy legislation through lobbying, and then you have the revolving door where politicians are going in and out of public office and then serving the interests that they just wrote legislation for and cashing in on it.
So it seems like Occupy is the only real movement that's raising these issues with a rigor and with a passion that's been missing in our whole society. And I think they've changed the conversation conversation about these issues to include what's really going on into the conversation, which is an achievement. Of course, we can't rely on our media for that. Unfortunately, just today, by the way, the new jobs numbers came out reporting that only 115,000 jobs were created. You need to create between 200,000 and 300,000 jobs just to remain, you know, for things to remain the way they are. So the official rate is 8.1%. But everybody who's followed this knows that it doesn't count people who have given up looking for work. It doesn't. It understates unemployment by minorities and young people. I've just read a report that one out of every two college students who graduate can't find a job. So this is almost unprecedented. Do you agree, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, this also has to do with the evolution of technology. I mean, the fact of the matter is we just don't need as many workers as we did to produce, you know, what we've been producing. There has to be, you know, this evolution where, you know, more people work less. Otherwise, you know, you have, you know, half the population's already living on a dollar a day. I mean, it's just the system of exploitation through, you know, unregulated crony capitalism. It's just there's the only way to, you know, fix things is to hit the reset button here. And I mean, it's.
Yeah, I would just, you know, add to this, you know, because David is not as much of a seller as he is a teller. But you can get his book on the economic elite versus the people of the United States at ampstatus.com. And it's worth getting because he's done a tremendous amount of research to back up his views. It's not somebody who's just talking off the top of his head just by way of self-promotion. I can indicate that, you know, I've also done a book called Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street, coming out from Cosimo Press, and a new book supposed to be out today called Blogathon, which is a collection of my blogs at newsdissector.net. So, you know, I'm trying to contribute to this discourse. I also have a piece up on aljazeera.com today dealing with Occupy and a debate about, you know, how Occupy can move forward. Noam Chomsky is now part of an organization called IOPS.org, the International Organization of for a Participatory Society, IOPS. And Chomsky is actually, who's been, you know, kind of a rock star on campuses speaking for years, is now actively involved on one of their committees on this new effort. So you can check that out, IOPS.org. It's an outgrowth of ZNet, which has been going for quite some time, raising these issues. David, final point, because I promised you I'd only keep you briefly. What do we have to, you know, kind of anticipate, look forward to as the you know, election year continues here? Do you see and do you want to see more of a focus on money and politics?
Absolutely. You know, I've spent the past 3 months working behind the scenes to just organize a network with, whether it's influential people, organizers throughout the country, activists, you know, focusing on getting money out of politics. It occupies about many different vital issues. But, you know, as far as I see it, the underlying root cause of that is money in politics, the corrupt culture in Washington. And so I'm focusing, you know, all my efforts right now just on actions and campaigns to get money out of politics and, you know, fight back against the corruption of our political system.
David, thanks for joining us. Again, you can reach David and read his work at ampstatus.com. My blog is newsdissector.net. We want you involved in these issues. This is not just like a one-shot thing, Mayday, big boom, big apocalypse, and it's all over. No, this is an ongoing effort. And, you know, in order to keep this movement moving, we need, you know, kind of a cultural component, too. We need to hear, you know, some music. We need to hear from people who are creators and who are trying to inspire activities. So even in this tiny little studio, basically three phone booths put together in the days when we used to have phone booths, we have the guitar me here, and we're going to hear a little bit more from them for the next few minutes. So you're listening to News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Guitar me, rock on.
All right. Rides, an old song by Florence Reese written in 1937 about a labor strike, coal mining strike in 1931.
In Harlan County.
Harlan County, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
So we do some old lyrics, we do some new lyrics, but I'll do the old one first.
Is in the studio here also. We played a little from your CD War a week or two ago, and just wanted to get your sense of how the organizing is going in terms of cultural workers and the music of Occupy.
We are pushing out on all cylinders right now. I mean, it's going great. I mean, the Guitarmy was like, you know, just a great first big action, and it got like kind of national exposure, and it's helping the Occupy movement break into some kind of press, because we don't get anything. I mean, you saw the press the next day. The only press we got was music press. So hopefully we can just keep busting open that music press until we get like a good story in Reuters or anything, you know? Like,
yeah, it's interesting. RT, Russia Today, does a better job, and Press TV, of covering Occupy than—
I'm sure
than
Voice of America does an amazing job in Russia, you know?
You know, like, so this, you know, this is the whole thing. But it seems as if the Progressive Radio Network is certainly trying to help amplify your voices. That's why, you know, we had you on today, thanks to Kat reaching out, sending a message through the underground to have you here. But I'm also interested in the fact that there's a radio show that you've been involved in as well.
Oh, Radio WS. Yeah,
with,
we've been doing
Polarity One.
Radio WS, we've been doing a monthly show. Our next show is going to be about women's issues. Our last show was about May Day, which was great. And
the mixtape.
Oh, then we also have a mixtape that Occupy.com. It's up there, but May Day mixtape. So we've been like kind of pushing out for May Day to be the first big beachhead of our summer movement.
So, you know, Occupy.com is a new site, I think. Tell us what's on it.
Totally. Well, this is Alfonso. Occupy.com has really launched as an effort to really unify all the different media voices that have been going on within Occupy. You have like the Occupy Wall Street Journal and Occupy.net and all these great places. But culturally, we really wanted a place for somebody that doesn't know much about the movement can come, really experience, read, watch videos, listen to music, you know, read articles, as it was said before, and get engaged. That's the whole point.
I think, you know, we want to also emphasize that there have been some very prominent artists that have been very supportive of Occupy. There's a new album out, I believe, in England of music for the movement, and perhaps more albums coming out here as well. It seems to have stirred a lot of interest and a lot of solidarity and support. You know, Jackson Browne was here, and Bonnie Raitt has performed. many others as well. And, you know, they're welcome, too.
Exactly.
The more the merrier, because if you have, there is some celebrity, that seems to attract the celebrity-crazed media.
Yeah.
And maybe while they're there, they can notice that something else is going on.
I mean, that's totally. Basically what we did on May Day. That's right. The only reason why MTV or any of these people were there is because of celebrities that we brought in.
Yeah, and big ups to Tom Morello, honestly, for really
Well, Tom Morello is really
a
conscious, you know, person, and he was so, you know, articulate about his passion about all of this. And he, you know, he puts his guitar where his mouth is, even if the guitar string breaks.
He was there.
And I think, you know, that's important because it also encourages more people. So as we finish up this half hour here on News Dissector Radio, do you have a song you can go out with?
We can do that. Before we go, we just want to let everybody know that Guitar Me is an open source band, meaning anyone can get involved. So if you would like to get down with some of the musical actions that we're doing, send us an email at music@nycga.net or follow us on Twitter at OWS Music Group.
We also have OccupyGuitarMe at .tumblr.com. You can check out more.
For those who don't know, Tom Morello is from the band Rage Against the Machine.
Yes, very important.
Post-Rage.
Never-ending Rage.
Which is pretty amazing. So this song is a really important song because this is kind of an anthem of our country. And to me, it's important because can I have a little music while I talk just to give me a feeling of being participating in this? You know, to me, it's important because I think we have to occupy the culture of our country. We have to occupy, you know, the goals and the aspirations of the mainstream of our country and not just talk to ourselves. We've got to reach out to all Americans. And one way of doing it is through songs that send a powerful message. You'll recall that this song was sung by both Pete Seeger and Bruce Springsteen at the inauguration in 2008. But it's a song that has a lot of meaning for a lot of people. So let's go out with that. Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land.
As I went walking, I saw a sign, and on that sign it said, No trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. In the shadow of a steeple, I saw my people. At the relief office, I saw my people, and they were hungry. Which left me wondering, is this land made for you and me? This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. Nobody living will ever stop me. As I go walking down freedom's highway, nobody living will ever turn me around. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Islands, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
One more time.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Islands. From the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
This is Bhavani from IE Green. Tune in Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern to hear my latest vegetarian and vegan recipes. Explore the latest issues dealing with our health, our food system, environment, sustainability, and more. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Last, an alternative to the ravings of right-wing radio. The Burt Cohen Show digs down to give you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all. I'm Burt Cohen, and I make full use of over 40 years of experience as an anti-war activist, political columnist, and 7 terms as state senator in conservative New Hampshire to uncover the real stories behind today's headlines. Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time at PRN.FM. If you miss a show, you can check it out on the archives. And if you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Johnny Mueller of the Expat Files, living in Latin America. It's the only show of its kind that tells you exactly what it's like to live, work, and or play in Latin America. So if you're thinking about getting off that first world treadmill, or just curious about how you can live a first world lifestyle down here in Latin America for a third of what you pay up in the States, and with half the stress, like I've been doing for the last 20 years, just tune in Monday and Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or click on the archives for all my past shows at PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. With us.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us. With us. With us.
Fridays at 5 p.m., have a vinyl experience.
Not this record!
The Vinyl Experience. The radio show all about records. All kinds of music sourced from LPs. It's our story in sound. Join me, Paul Cavalcante, for an analog adventure. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN, PRN for the Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank.
Few minutes late, but Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Cat Waters, and welcoming to our program a woman who I spoke to years ago, and I'm not sure if you remember, Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a secretary, assistant secretary of housing in the Reagan administration. I believe it was the Reagan administration. I could be wrong about that. And who is an investment, you know, advisor, but beyond that, an analyst of what's happening to our economy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Danny, of course I remember you. No one ever forgets you. That would never happen.
I was so thrilled that you would come on. We're doing this radio show every week and trying to integrate some sort of economic analysis and political back talk, you know, about what's going on in the economy. Uh-huh. And sometimes just before you came on here, we had the guitar army of Occupy Wall Street, which is like 6 guitars in a space the size of, you know, one of those old telephone booths, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, it's been a little supercharged in here.
I bet it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was beautiful. And, the energy and the passion and the way in which these issues have now found a popular voice and people are fascinated, want to know more, want to learn more, want to do something to make change. You were out there preaching on this in the wilderness, so to speak. You know, when we spoke in the aftermath of 9/11, these issues weren't as clear to a lot of people. They were clear to you, and you were talking about, the tax system, the financial system in our country and how screwed up it is and everything else. But now,
well, I call it financial coup d'état, and I think many of us did not study finance in high school, so I think it's been hard for people to fathom that the financial system is working very differently than their sort of official picture of how it's supposed to work.
When did this occur? When did you begin to learn about it? Was it being inside government and seeing?
No, I grew up in a very poor neighborhood. So I watched the drugs come into my neighborhood and the financial fraud, the mortgage fraud, because the mortgage fraud we saw during the last round is very, it's been going on for centuries, Danny.
Right.
And I watched it destroy my neighborhood. And one of the things that occurred to me, I would have said it differently when I was 10 years old, was the equity value being destroyed is much greater than the money the guys are making on the HUD financial fraud. It was really interesting. One of the reasons I got really interested in learning about how money works is I used to walk by these four boarded up HUD homes, and they would have a big sign that said, by order of the Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner. I used to think, who is that idiot? And so when I was sworn in as Assistant Secretary of Housing, my hand was on the Bible, and the secretary said, by order of the president, now you're the Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Administration. I said, oh, no, I'm the idiot. So I went downstairs.
What do you think this is an issue which I've been following closely. I made the movie Plunder, the Crime of Our Time.
Yeah, no, you
about
really
financial
nailed it.
Crime and debt we trust, looking at all of these issues.
Uh-huh.
Why can't this administration, supposedly a pro-people administration, seem to do anything about it? They've talked about helping, the victims of this foreclosure crisis repeatedly. They've set up, kinds of funds that end up helping, 20,000 people maybe over years, and while the problem involves millions of people. What is the problem?
Several reasons. One is you have a financial system which is highly leveraged with what I call collateral fraud and naked short selling. So you have a real discrepancy in what's supposed to be on the books and what, is truly going on. And it's resulted in a system which is unbelievably fragile, which means that everything has to be done to keep it going. So that's number one. Number two, financial fraud is a huge business that has financed a variety of things, including governmental projects. I call it the black budget. What everybody in the system wants is for the cash flows to keep working. So if you sit down and address what's going on, not only do you cut off the cash flow to all sorts of projects, big and small, all over the country and all over the world, but you also could crash the global financial system. And there's no popular support to do that. In other words, at the root of it, what we're talking about is a model of running our economy. I call it the central banking warfare model. And it's not financially sustainable. In other words, we have to keep composting people and countries, and, somebody's got to lose to keep the thing going as a subsidy. And part of what's happening is people are doing everything they can to keep the model going. And that's why you see so much discussion all around the world saying we need a new model. You bet you do, because we're rebalancing the economy to build up the emerging markets, and we can't build them up and kill them at the same time to keep subsidizing the model. So I think the reality is the federal government is dependent on that financial fraud to keep the, to keep the boats churning along, and it's a real financial problem. The final thing is, if you look at who runs a lot of the fraud, they're dangerous people, and they have the power to kill with impunity. We've seen hundreds of people, destroyed and poisoned and killed and, assassinated and everything else. And so this is a dangerous business, and people don't want to get killed.
Hold on. I don't think your mic is on, Catherine. Hello.
Hello?
Yeah, we're just trying to get Catherine in the conversation.
Okay.
Cat Waters is here in the house, but the mic doesn't seem to be working. All right, we'll figure it out. We'll come back to you, Kat, in a second. I just wanted to ask you a question about whether or not you think this is at heart the conflict between, you know, in a sense, property rights over human rights. In other words, the people who are, you know, put their lives on the line, their families' fortunes on the line, and were talked into taking some of these fraudulent mortgages. Everybody acknowledges there was fraud. The FBI said it was pervasive. And yet, somehow, both the Republican Bush administration and the Democratic Obama administration can't seem to come up with a plan to do anything about it.
Well, but I think they do have a plan to do something. In other words, the fraud, what you saw was the fraudulent inducement of America. I call it the financial coup d'etat. And it was a plan, Danny. They knew what they were doing. It was intentional. They pumped and dumped the housing market and used that to pull huge amounts of capital out of the North America and reinvest it in a variety of other places. We can speculate about that, what that is, but certainly one of them was the emerging markets. And it was absolutely a plan. So when you pay a huge number of people at Freddie, Fannie, FHA, HUD, you know, all the big banks to go off and do something, and they do a great job. They did a great job at doing it. It was an incredible financial engineering coup. It got them trillions of dollars. They issued tons of phony baloney paper. Then they refinanced the phony baloney paper, you know, with the bailout. So, you know, we know how a leveraged buyout of a company works. We've seen leveraged buyouts of countries. Now we're watching literally the leveraged buyout of a planet. And it worked. They issued trillions of dollars of phony paper and then refinanced it out on the bailout. And the reason they haven't punished people for doing it is it was a plan and it worked. So they gave everybody bonuses.
Hey, Catherine. So then it stands to reason along the lines of what you're saying, then the only way it's going to change is for the people to do it. And hopefully it doesn't have to get to the point where so many people have just been, you know, so displaced. You know, like hopefully it doesn't have to get to that point and they do it kind of before it gets.
Okay, so let me be a really, really bad guy. The reality is the mortgage bubble was not just engineered by Wall Street and Washington. I mean, certainly it was engineered in the first step by them, and, you know, it took a lot of work and a lot of getting a lot of honest people out of the way and changing a lot of laws and regulations, and, you know, so it's a lot of hard work. But if you look all across America in every community, because America just breaks down into 3,100 counties, everybody went along with the party. Everybody said, oh, I can make a whole lot of money. So, you know, part of the problem with the housing bubble is you have the entire population complicit in doing something, you know, that many people knew didn't make sense. There were thousands of appraisers who knew what was going on was wrong and nuts. I mean, we all know as a society that this kind of behavior can't make sense. So we're looking at something that where there's a lot of complicity. And let me just give you an example. I have a very famous story that I often tell to understand the depth of the problem, because I think to find real solutions, we've got to understand the depth. I was giving a speech called How the Money Works in Organized Crime to a great group of people who had a conference in Philadelphia, and the topic of discussion was how to evolve our society spiritually. So a friend of mine had asked me to give a speech called How the Money Works in Organized Crime. I'm in the middle of the speech talking about the congressional hearings on CIA drug dealing into South Central LA, and the fact that someone from the Department of Justice had just said that the U.S. financial system launders $500 billion to $1 trillion of all illegal monies, and so that's 1998. I'm sure it's much more now. And so I said to this wonderful group of people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in dirty money? And they said, well, you know, our taxes might go up because we'd have trouble financing the government deficit, and our government checks might stop, and our IRAs might go down because that money would go to Zurich and Hong Kong instead of coming to the New York Stock Exchange. So I said, okay, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. If you push that button, you could stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your neighborhood tomorrow. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our government checks to stop. We don't want our taxes to go up, and we don't want our IRAs
to go down. So we're all invested in this fraudulent system. There's an article.
Absolutely.
There's an article in the New York Times today, which I found fascinating. It's about AIG, once the biggest insurance company in the world. And they say their earnings have doubled in the first quarter. And then if you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs, you get into a little of the context of this. And it says, you know, you've got to kind of, you can't just read the top. You got to, actually, you should read most of this news from the bottom up, not the top down. But AIG, it says, got the biggest bailout of the financial crisis. The Treasury Department provided $68 billion under the financial bailout program, I guess the TARP program. And we all thought, well, they got $68 billion. These guys are total crooks. And you remember the first thing they did was they paid off 100% to their counterparty, Goldman Sachs, immediately. You know, but so this was federal money going to, you know, AIG. But the article, the paragraph goes on. It says, and the New York Fed gave AIG a $114 billion lifeline. The total bailout was $182.5 billion, not $68 billion. And the Fed printed up the rest of this money. And they say AIG has repaid all but $17.5 billion of the money.
Right.
So, you know, here you have a situation where the government in collusion with this, you know, company, which was admittedly totally deceptive and dishonest in what they were doing, gets billions of dollars and, you know, basically has years to pay it back, you know, and makes money on the money.
Right. Well, let me make this worse for you. I was part of a group of
worse.
People in the first.
God.
No, but because we have to see. You know, we keep saying that things are going wrong as if the model of what the official reality, you know, we keep affirming the official reality, and it's time to leave the official reality and start looking at the system as the way it really operates. Because one of the things to understand about the people, whether they run Wall Street or they run, you know, the federal government, is there are a remarkable number of people who are highly competent, and the system is going where it wants to go. I mean, it's competent to either go where it wants to go or to change. And I think it's time to get out of the official reality and say, okay, we're dealing with a financial coup d'etat. That's what this is. So, but let me make it worse just for a second. I was part of a group of people in the first Bush administration.
The Bush administration, is what you
Yeah, the, who got laws passed requiring audited financial statements to be produced by government. And so a process went into place in 1995 when the Treasury started to publish why they wouldn't or couldn't publish audited financial statements. They've never done it. So every year we send our 1040s to government and say, here's how our money works, and the federal government refuses to comply and send back financial statements, audited financial statements. So, but this process began where they started to say, well, we can't, and here's why. And what started to come out from some agencies is they had what's called undocumentable adjustments, which means they
say,
can't
Hold on. Let's take a deep breath. Say that term again, okay? Just so
undocumentable adjustments.
Undocumentable adjustments. That's a new one to me. Yeah.
Right. So let's say your checking account, your checkbook says that you've got $50,000, you know, in your money market account at your bank, and your bank sends you a statement that says, "Oh, you only have $25,000," and you write into your checking book, you know, undocumentable adjustment $25,000, and the bank says, "We promise never to let it happen again." Would that happen? No. You'd say, go find my $25,000 and I want it back. Okay, in the spring of 1997, I was giving a presentation to a group of pension fund leaders, including the largest pension fund in the country, CalPERS, showing them how we could re-engineer government investment by county and completely turn around the economy and basically support the middle class, particularly in their retirement, as we were globalizing the whole global economy and moving all the jobs to, you know, into Asia and the emerging markets. So the head of CalPERS said to me, wait a minute, you don't understand. It's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. That fall, Danny, was the beginning of fiscal 1998, and that's when the federal government exploded in undocumentable adjustments, and over $4 trillion went missing from the Pentagon, NASA, and HUD. And no
went,
one...
Hold on. That's another deep gulp here. Went
right.
missing.
Went missing. Undocumentable adjustments. In 1 year, the day before 9/11, Don Rumsfeld stood up at the Department of Defense, gave a press release and said, you know, admitted that the Pentagon was missing $2.3 trillion the year before, which is more than the entire federal budget in that year. So, or it was more than the total individual tax.
But your view is this really wasn't missing. They kind of knew where it was.
No, they shifted the money out. It was a plan.
So in other words, they're basically like figuring in, you know, for like the corruption. Like they're actually kind of working the math of corruption like into the figures.
Corruption is a cover story.
Right, but not calling it
what
that.
What they want. The greatest cover story ever devised is incompetence, that government is incompetent. I assure you, government is not incompetent.
When
the powers that be want government to move from the right to the left, whew, like a hot knife through butter, you have more competent, solid line management in government, particularly the military, than in any place I've ever seen.
Whether it's corrupt or incompetent, I mean, they should be removed from their position either way.
Well, you know, the problem that I think Catherine is pointing to is this has been a coup d'etat. In other words, the people who are the financial engineers, managers, and top-level people, the elite of the elite, you know, made decisions about what to do about this money. And go ahead. Sorry.
We made a decision. It was called the strong dollar policy. We decided that we were going to reinvest because at the end of World War II, America had 50% of the resources and 6% of the people. And the reality is, you know, Goldwater got up and he said to the American people, look, you know, to keep 6% of the people with 50% of the resources, we're going to have to be tough. We're going to have to drop some bombs. And the American people said, oh, no, you know, we're good Christians. And so Jimmy Carter said, okay, well, then we're going to have to cut back because, you know, we're going to have to cut back to our 6%. So he shivered in front of the fireplace. The American people said, oh, no, we don't want to be deprived. And so the Bushes came along and said, you know something? Here's your check. Don't ask questions. And everybody said, oh, that works. Okay.
So there's a lot of self-interest in all of this, but there's also a lot of deception.
Right. And our power, here's the thing. The minute we can face our complicity in this and face what's going on in the model, that's how we get our power. Because we need to solve a problem, and that is that literally we have a breakaway civilization. We have a group of people who've just said, look, we can't operate within these laws anymore. I saw it in the Bush administration. I was Assistant Secretary of Housing. The Secretary of HUD got furious at a regional administrator at one point who had made a decision, and the regional administrator said to him, but Mr. Secretary, I had to do that. It was the law. The secretary went nuts. He started just screaming. He said, the law, the law. I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. You know, he was kind of referring to the eyes wide shut folks. And basically, you know, these guys believed they were above the law. If you watch Charlie Ferguson's documentary on Iraq, same thing. They believed they were above the law. Just, you know, go in and do whatever you want. So you have a group of people who are now operating, including through the financial system, using fraud with impunity, and they are off, you know, financing and reengineering basically global governance, and they're pulling money out of the first world, Europe and North America, and shifting that money into the emerging markets, and I suspect into space and high tech government. If you look at the amount of money that has been shifted out of North America and Europe, it is enough to create an endowment to finance a private government to run the world.
They also seem to think they're above the laws of nature and physics, too.
Well, here's the question, and I don't know the answer. I mean, number one question is, who are they? And number two question is, what is the knowledge that they have that we don't have? Because one of the things I will tell you is, you know, I don't pretend to have ever been a very important person or operated very high levels, but to the extent that I was a partner in a Wall Street firm, and that firm was run by people who ended up in very high senior positions in the Bush administration. I did work in a government agency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, I've had the opportunity to get glimpses inside the powers that be. And what I'll tell you, everybody is struggling within a global model. And so if you look at people in what I call the Anglo-American Alliance, they're having to compete globally with other groups. And, you know, that game is dirt ball. And if you were the American financial system, you want to have huge banks so you can compete with the Chinese. you know, whose banks are getting much bigger than ours.
Let me just jump in here for a minute, because we've introduced so many ideas that we don't have time to really fully explore. But I would like for you to tell, you know, listeners where they can reach you. You do a report that deals with a lot of these issues regularly. Tell us about it and how they can be in touch with you.
Sure. My website is Soleri.com, and I publish the Soleri Report, and our tagline is building personal and family wealth in changing times. And our goal with the Soleri Report is to help our subscribers understand what's going on in the world in a way that they can navigate their families and assets, you know, safely over to the other side, if you will. So,
well, thank you so much, you know, for being on. I'd love to have you back so we can talk some more about this. Thank you, Kat, for organizing this.
Thank you, Devlin.
And you know, it's so nice to be back in touch with you. And I hope we can, you know, see each other again soon, because I think your analysis is not only, you know, at the time I first heard it, I thought it was a little, you know, a fantasy land. But no, I think you're right on target, and I think we need to understand it more clearly. So thanks for joining us. You can follow my work on newsdissector.net. I have a new book coming out called Blogathon, a book on Occupy, Dissecting Occupy Wall Street from Cosimo Books. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org, dissector@mediachannel.org. Thanks so much for listening to News Dissector Radio. Thank you, Kat Waters, for helping to organize this amazing show we had today. And it's time to leave you now. Let's do so with some music. Hey.
We go. Trust. If you can't maintain a certain amount, no bank is gonna let you have a checking account. So when you gotta cash a check cause your kids need to eat, there's a check cashing place about a block up the street. When the money's tight, you don't have to wait. There's a 500% interest rate that you keep rolling over on that payday loan. And if you can't afford a freezer, you can rent to own. You gotta make those payments, bro, you can't miss one. You can buy it three times over by the time that you're done. If you do miss a payment, they will repossess. And when your ice cream melts, it's gonna make a mess. Cause they're predators, predators. They keep devouring more and more. They're predators, predators. They're getting richer by preying on the poor.